You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
What happened in international politics, environmental issues, immigration, and LGBTQ rights? What were the most censored news stories of the past 3 years? How is the fight against white nationalism progressing?
Captain Hindsight!
We spend this day looking back so we can spend the rest of the year working together towards justice, equity, and democracy with hope and determination. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Welcome to Personal Risk Management, the new frontier of data sharing and cybersecurity and privacy information. I'm Claire Rosciotto. Today, I'll be speaking with an accomplished cyber and security and privacy information lawyer and educator. Every day, millions of Americans tap in and out of their phones using apps from Google Maps to social media such as Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. These apps and other technology we use on a regular and even daily basis that many agree make our lives easier, interactive, and entertaining are at the same time collecting our personal information. So, at what point are these technological tools that assist our lives becoming too capable of harming us without our knowledge, possibly? One prime example of this that already took place is the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where millions of Facebook users' private information became political gold. So, as we'll discuss today, it is imperative to know our own role in this developing tech-centered society and how to manage our private and personal information from possibly getting into the wrong hands, and for some of us, for that happening again. My guest today is Debray Kennedy Mayo, who is a research faculty member at the Georgia Tech Scheller College of Business. She works directly with Peter Swire, serving as part of a small team of attorneys at Georgia Tech who engage in research on legal and policy issues concerning privacy and cybersecurity. Swire and Kennedy Mayo are the co-authors of the 2018 edition of U.S. Private Sector Privacy, Law and Practice for Information Privacy Professionals, and are currently working on the 2020 edition of the book. Kennedy Mayo has been an attorney for nearly 20 years. She has spent most of her career working in government, acting as both an assistant attorney general for the state of Georgia and as an assistant district attorney in several Georgia counties. Kennedy Mayo has also pursued several entrepreneurial ventures. She graduated with honors from Emory Law School in Atlanta. Thank you for joining us, Debray Kennedy Mayo.
Good morning, Debray. How are you today?
Doing fine. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we begin, we did a brief introduction of you. Can you give us a little more context to your day-to-day work schedule and what do you do in your day?
It's interesting because my day-to-day work schedule really changes quite a bit.
I'm sure.
That's part of what makes it fun and exciting. And certainly what's happening in the news and in the media often impacts that. For example, this week, the beginning of the week, we finalized the third edition of the book that Peter Swire and I have written on privacy. We then started an online privacy class at Georgia Tech. Yesterday, I was in a conversation with individuals across the world about moving data across international borders for law enforcement purposes. Today I'm having an interview with you, and the rest of my week probably looks like research on issues related to India.
Interesting. That's fascinating. I think our listeners will be really interested in hearing more about your research and the daily work that you do. As you know, especially in this political climate, cybersecurity and privacy is very much on the minds of many folks in the United States and across the world, frankly. Before we get into more of that, can you talk about what inspired you to get into the field of cybersecurity and privacy?
My interest really started while I was in law school, which has been quite a few years ago now. And I started to see that what was happening on the internet was really going to transform the law. Mm-hmm. The law around that was going to change almost every day, and I wanted to be involved in that. Someone who really liked tech, done a lot with math in my life, and so I really wanted to be in a field that was going to pull in technology and math and science, but also was really going to be on the cutting edge. So I did a little bit of that when I was in law school, wrote on a treaty that was coming out at that time related to cybercrime. Mm-hmm. And then I really didn't have another opportunity to really do a lot until the Snowden disclosures in 2013. And for me, that became really a change in my career, because I really wanted to devote a lot of my time to trying to deal with that. And ultimately for me, that was how technology had changed the ability of governments to really surveil us. And what we find out is that the U.S. actually has a lot of safeguards in place around technology, more than a lot of other countries in the world. And it just happened to be that one of the people who looked at that for the U.S. government was Peter Swire, who's the person that I work with on a daily basis now.
So I want to get into that. Before we really dig deep into this, can you give our audience common person's understanding of what the difference between is cybersecurity and privacy, and how do they go together in the work that you do?
And those issues can be really tricky and get very, very technical.
For sure.
When we're with students in particular at Georgia Tech trying to explain those concepts, particularly from a policy and legal look, mm-hmm. what we talk about is cybersecurity being basically inappropriate access to data, such as what a hacker would do, mm-hmm. and privacy really looking at the limits on what appropriate access and transferring and use of that data would be. So the two overlap in many ways that are important, and if you're from the more technical side, the cybersecurity can get very, very technical and really go into a lot of details, but at a high level, that would be the way that I would describe cybersecurity and privacy.
That's great. And then folks can do their own research. And so going back to what you were just talking about, can you talk about how you were saying over time, especially when you were studying the law, how cybersecurity and privacy specifically has changed in terms of how it affects government and government's control?
Well, one basic idea that I think could help explain what I'm talking about is how we as citizens in the United States interact with and have limits on our government. Mm-hmm. Back to the founding of the U.S., we have the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says that if law enforcement are going to look at you from a criminal perspective, if they're going to do an investigation, then for a search as defined under our Constitution, they have to go and get a search warrant from a judicial officer, from a judge. Well, that is pretty easy to understand if you're talking about going into my house and doing a search. Today, we have to figure out how you apply those Fourth Amendment standards to data that may be stored with a company. What's the search there? What does that mean? And for lawyers, those are whole new concepts that we have to try and understand, and it's part of my work on a daily basis.
That is fascinating. Are there any cases, whether they're your own or ones that you have studied within the United States, that you can speak to that involve this very issue? And what were the results of those cases?
Well, the United States Supreme Court has actually looked at a line of cases in the past few years that really try and figure out how you deal with technology and the Fourth Amendment. So a few years ago, there was a Jones case that looked at really putting a tracker onto a vehicle, and could you do that? There was the Riley case that said, you know, what about the data on your phone? Do you have to get a search warrant to get access to the data on somebody's phone? Most recently at the United States Supreme Court, we had the Carpenter case that really said, okay, you can find out a lot about a person by knowing their location using cell towers. Mm-hmm. Do we need to have a search warrant for that? And the Supreme Court has come back and said, yeah, we need to have search warrants in these instances. So it's very slowly developing perhaps a new, more global approach to how they're going to do that. But right now we're getting it incrementally in cases. And so those are a few that have made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are several others that in the area that I'm working in may not have made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but are certainly starting to impact how people are working on a day-to-day basis in the field.
And in your work personally, can you talk about any cases? I know you do a lot of research and you're an educator, but are there cases in which you are representing a client and you're trying to make sure that their privacy is protected? Is that anything that you specifically do?
Well, I can tell you about what is happening cross-border, which mm-hmm. I think might be quite interesting to your listeners. And those involve lots and lots of criminal cases. So I'll try and give you an example of a criminal case where this would come up. So if we were in France and there had been a burglar of a home in France, and it appeared that the person who had committed the crime was in France, and it appeared that the victim was in France, it is quite possible that key evidence in that case could be with Facebook or Apple or Microsoft or Google. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then under the laws as they exist today, the law enforcement officer in France would have to make a request that would go under what's called mutual legal assistance, an MLAT, is the acronym that's often used for the treaty, and that would have to go from the local person in France to someone very high up in the French government, mm-hmm. to the U.S. Department of Justice, then down to a local prosecutor in Silicon Valley. Then a judge would have to issue an order, and then the evidence would have to be returned all the way back through that chain.
And that's if that was approved, right?
If it's approved. And that would take about 10 months is the average that is out there.
Wow, that's incredible. That's so fascinating to hear. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so obviously that's a problem, and it's been identified around the world. Mm-hmm. And we in the U.S. are very fortunate that we have major tech companies that are located in the U.S., but that delay is something that we're hearing around the world. And so the international meeting that I was in earlier this week, we were talking about these issues. And the U.S. government has attempted to address this with something that's called the Cloud Act to try and make this process work faster so that person who is a law enforcement officer in France could make the request directly to the service provider that happens to be in the U.S. But it's a long process under the Cloud Act to get that approved. You have to have what's called an executive agreement between the country that's involved and the U.S. UK or India, that would have to happen. And right now we're waiting to see which of those agreements are going to actually happen.
Gotcha. And I'd like to get into more of that. Can you talk about some of the specific differences between data access between the United States and other countries, such as you mentioned? Because it seems in your research that there seems to be a pretty stark difference between the two, that there are more regulations, if you will, or restrictions rather, to access data on personal devices in the United States versus other countries.
I'll step back and give you kind of an overview.
Okay, thank you.
That I think it's helpful to understand it more generally. Mm-hmm. In Europe, for example, the traditional focus has been on the interaction between the individual and the business. So that is what is traditionally been very regulated. In the United States, the traditional approach that we have taken has really focused on the individual and government. So like the Fourth Amendment search warrant requirements, that has really been a focus since the founding of our country. So we today still focus on that interaction. As far as the interaction between the individual and business, we have done that a lot by doing what's called sector specific. So we really look at healthcare information. We really look at financial information. And that has been different than, say, the European approach mm-hmm. has traditionally been.
That is super fascinating. And I would like to know more about how can people protect their own privacy when online? You have done some research I've seen specifically in India about a social media app such as WhatsApp. Can you talk about ways in which folks, like as I said, be more mindful of what information is being gathered potentially when they're online?
And I would suggest that people can think of this as personal risk management. People actually have a good bit of control, and they have important decisions to make, but they really have to be conscious of the decisions they're making. So, say for social media, the first thing that you really have to consider is, do you want to be involved in social media? Mm-hmm. And for most people, the answer to that is yes. The next question that you really have to think about is, really think about on social media what you're posting. You know, I deal with a lot of students because I do teach classes, and so the easy way to say that for a student is, you know, 4 years down the road, do you want an employer to see that photograph?
For sure.
You know, for people that are past that age and aren't trying to necessarily get a new job, you know, particularly think if you're posting a photograph about another person. Mm. You know, if your grandmother would never want to be photographed at her birthday party, she didn't have on lipstick, don't photograph her when she's in the hospital and has tubes, you know, in her so you can get a selfie with her to show other people how she's doing.
Right.
You know, that's one of the things. Another thing that I really would suggest that people think, again, as far as the decisions that they have to make, or say with your smartphone, mm-hmm. location being on all the time allows a lot of tracking. And there are companies out there that specialize in just location that comes from smartphones. So, you know, make a decision. One, do you want to have it on? I personally leave mine off a lot of the time. But for a lot of people, they use location for certain apps. Mm-hmm. So consider whether it makes sense to turn it on when you're using the app, say for traffic, and then turn it off when you're not using that particular app. So make smart decisions and realize that you have a lot of control, and that it's really if you decide to use a particular type of technology, there are some risks associated with that, so you manage those risks.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Personal Risk Management, the new frontier of data sharing in cybersecurity and privacy information on KBOFM. And I'm speaking with attorney DeBray Kennedy Mayo.
Absolutely. I think that's a lot of very sound advice for folks who are listening of all ages. And I think a really, as most folks I think would understand and agree with, a case that really brought this to light in terms of how our information is being used online, specifically with social media, was the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal. And can you talk about what were some of the legalities involved in that?
Certainly. So first, let me talk a little bit from the legal side.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the case and the $5 billion fine that happened, it is certainly, you know, a noteworthy fine.
For sure.
But realize that this is what's called a consent decree. So Facebook has actually not said, yes, we did something. So it's not like a guilty plea in a criminal case. They didn't say, we did this. Mm-hmm. They have said, we are willing to pay the fine instead of having to go to a lawsuit where you have to prove that we did this. So the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has made lots of allegations, and Facebook has said, based on those allegations, we'll pay the fine. So as an attorney, I'm a little careful to say this is what's been alleged by the federal agency. They've alleged that Facebook was using contact information and providing it to a third party, which was Cambridge Analytica, in a way that users did not believe was happening.
Right.
Facebook, at least in some of the congressional testimony that I've seen, because I am a C-SPAN junkie, so I actually watch those hearings. Facebook came back and said, you know, actually, we didn't directly provide access to that information. We gave Cambridge Analytica certain information that was kind of compiled by Facebook. So Facebook was doing the manipulation of the data. And the reason that I point out the differences here, because one, from the legal perspective, what actually technically happened is important to whether a company violates. But more importantly for a general listener is, what is it that people in the U.S. think is appropriate for a company such as Facebook to be doing?
Right.
Is it okay to provide contact information, even if it's in the aggregate or even if it's manipulated by the company itself, to a third party? And we seem to be hearing the answer to that was no, fairly loudly. So, you know, is the line that it was information related to your contacts or your friends? So if you step back and say, okay, if Facebook had done that just to my data and I'm a Facebook user, would I have been okay with that? And a slightly different question that maybe comes as a derivative question from that is, is the problem here that it had to do with politics and dealing with how people were going to make decisions about politics? Because that seems to be a real critical point in the Cambridge Analytica case,
right,
is that this was being done for political issues, and that we find that to be a very important thing, particularly in the United States. And so we want to provide perhaps some additional protections around political ads. And so as you go forward, trying to figure out, you know, what exactly do we want to regulate as a society, we have to figure out exactly what it was in that case that really made us upset, so we can figure out, okay, we do want to do this, we perhaps don't want to do that. So it's complicated issues there, and I think it's important to continue the conversation about those issues.
Absolutely. And are there any laws, and thank you for that wonderful explanation of what happened and the legalities of it, but are there any laws that have come about or are starting to come about after this case that provide more protections or at the very least more awareness for personal data being shared?
In the U.S., we have an interesting legal system as far as the different levels that we have. So right now at the federal level, there's talk about doing a much more comprehensive federal privacy law. So it would be more similar to some of the ones that you see outside the U.S. and would be different than the approach that I talked about that was sector-based, so the healthcare and the financial. It would include all of your data.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's hard to pass a law at the federal level. So what we have seen that has happened is California's law, the CCPA, has gone into effect at the beginning of this year, and it is a much more comprehensive approach to how we're going to regulate privacy, so all the data of people who live in California is protected under that law. But for companies that are nationwide, mm-hmm, so they're across the United States, right now they're trying to figure out, are we going to give the protections under that California law to everybody around the country? So some of the restrictions that are in that California law have to do with, can you sell my data to a third party? You know, can I get my data from you and transfer it to another company? So that's what we're starting to see, is that states realize that perhaps we're not going to get a national law, are not going to get one quickly, and they're stepping up to say, well, maybe we need to do that. And some other states, since California has passed their law, are beginning to look at that more comprehensive approach to privacy regulation.
That's fascinating. And if that were to become a law in California, do you see that being something that could potentially become national, or at the very least kind of trickle into other states and become a little bit more common?
The California law has gone into place as of the beginning of 2020. And what we have seen in the past is that when California, you know, passes at least certain types of law, it does kind of trickle around the rest of the nation. California was a very early adopter of legislation related to data breach notification, so a law that would require the companies to let people know if there had been a data breach. And as of, I believe, a year ago, all 50 states have adopted a data breach notification law. So there is reason to believe that the California law that went into effect just a few weeks ago is going to have a major impact across the United States.
And not to cause any like fear among listeners, but is there any way for any firm or say small group of people to mimic what Facebook Cambridge Analytica did? Is that possible, say, going into the next election for that to happen again legally?
That's a tricky question okay. to answer. So let me try to say, the restrictions that were on Facebook that led to the $5 billion civil penalty, the specific restrictions actually came because Facebook was already under one of those consent decrees from 2012. So that's why the Federal Trade Commission was specifically able to go after Facebook and give them that large of a fine. Had that 2012 consent order not been there, it would have been more difficult to have gone after them in the way that the Federal Trade Commission did. That doesn't mean Federal Trade Commission couldn't have gone after them, but the penalty in the way that it happened would have been much more unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, again, not to scare your listeners,
right.
is that right now in the United States, we don't restrict that kind of use of data in the way that a lot of people perhaps would like or think is out there. So the best way that your listeners can make sure that their personal data is not involved in that is to think about, you know, where their data is going when they provide it to a company. You know, think about the companies they provide it to. Again, Facebook is something a lot of people use. There are lots of other types of social media that people use. Could it happen? Something similar certainly could happen. There are a lot of things that have to fall into place for it to be the same impact as what happened in Cambridge Analytica.
But just to clarify, there aren't any hard and fast laws in place that would prevent this firm happening again.
And I don't want to go quite that far.
Okay.
Certainly the California law for people that live in California and for companies that are dealing with California, those companies would be restricted. Companies that are doing business in Europe would have restrictions, and a lot of companies decide to do those across all of the consumers that they have, all their customers. And then again, because in the United States we have sector specific, so financial data, the medical data, and there are lots of other specific types that are restricted, it would be very specific to the type of company and what data that we were talking about. So there's not a blanket restriction that I can say to you, okay, this law would say, no, you can't do that.
For sure.
But a company would be having to be cautious in how they were doing it to be able to do something similar. So we also live in a post-Cambridge Analytica world. So quite a few companies have internally made decisions, okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to restrict how we deal with things from the political ad type of things. And there have been a lot of discussions about restricting data, making a decision as a company to restrict data from political ads. And there has been some discussion of that as well in Congress. So again, I don't want to make a blanket statement about there would not be any laws out there. Attorneys are very careful not to make suggestions like that. But I will say it's not a straightforward, it could never happen again statement either.
Right. No, I think that's what's interesting. And regardless of the laws that exist, I think it's important to note to listeners that, and generally for myself and anyone, that it's important to arm yourself with information and, you know how, not only how the laws work, but how you interact with technology and being mindful. That's important.
And this particular case, mm-hmm. Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, has certainly raised the consciousness of people in the United States. And so companies are taking that very seriously. That is certainly what I'm seeing in the media, and we deal with certain companies on projects, and that's certainly what I'm hearing there is, you know, it makes some sense to think about what advertisers are going to be doing with data. You know, so if we know that it's political, you know, perhaps we put in more restrictions. You know, this actually raises a larger issue with the internet today. You know, technology changes, and, you know, so an issue that may have not existed yesterday exists today. But right now, a lot of the revenue that business can get that are internet-based has to do with advertising. As long as that model continues, and right now it's a really successful one, then we're going to have to constantly think as citizens in the United States and consumers of businesses, you know, should there be restrictions on how that advertising is done, the information collected for that, and information being transferred related to that. So it's really an area that, again, heightening awareness for your listeners is important, because it's an area that we really need to think about. How is the best way to regulate that, and should that be done by business? Should they internally do self-regulation? And to what extent do we need laws at the federal level or at the state level to address that?
Thank you to my guest, Bray Kennedy Mayo, and you can hear this episode and more on KBOO's website and podcast app. My name is Claire Rosciato, and thank you for listening.
You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
Captain Hindsight!
Thank you for listening.
I will tell you this, 10 years ago, no one was talking about white nationalism or white supremacy. There are lots of myths about what the white nationalist movement is. Stereotypes are that they are uneducated, folks who live in rural areas, isolated. But in fact, the white nationalist movement pretty much mirrors the demographics of the United States. It is a movement that has been growing steadily.